And I'm recording right now. Wonderful.
You're recording right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You should be able to see my screen. Okay. I just want to start where we kind of left off on Monday. So just as a quick reminder, we looked at a mock data set and tried to reconstruct proton-produced ethers. And we performed like a regular analysis and reconstructed some ether-like channels, and then we went on and introduced kinematic fitting. And as a result, we have this nice equation here for the chi-square, which consists of two parts. One part dedicated to the epsilon, which is basically the correction to your measured form momenta. You have a physics reaction with n particles, and the epsilon is a three times n long vector describing the correction on each measured form momentum. So this allows you to improve the resolution. And we have a second part, including constraints, right? Because the particles follow a certain law, physics law, so we enforce energy momentum conservation. This is what the second part is all about. All right. And then, we found that basically the fit provides us with two information. One are the fitted particle momenta. So for instance, imagine you have a detector and I don't know, for some reason you want to measure a photon with high precision, but your detector only gives you very bad photon resolution, but your pion or charged particle resolution is brilliant. So what a kinematic fit, for instance, could do is you could set up a reaction you're interested in. Let's say the reaction includes charge and neutral particles, perform the fit, and then obtain the fitted information for the photon. So this would help you to improve the resolution for an observable. Or if you don't care about resolution, but you want to clean up your data because you have a lot of background channels, then use the fitter as a background rejection method. Both is possible. Also, as I said, more on as we discussed on Monday, energy momentum conservation is not the only constraint. You can also constrain particle masses or vertex. Again, in our case, vertex doesn't make any sense because we don't have the vertex information. Also, I'm sorry about that I did not include it here, is including missing particles. Sorry for that. This is also very interesting, right? You could say this is something the class experiment does. They have not a good photon resolution, so they usually measure protons and pions. And if they're looking, for example, at proton plus or minus pi zero, they fit to the missing pi zero. The kinematic fit. So this is also a nice way to recover the missing information via the kinematic fit. This is really nice. Again, one very important input for the kinematic fit, besides the reaction you're interested in, is the matrix V, called the weight matrix or covariance matrix. Technically, these are two different things. In least squares fitting, it's the weight matrix. Kinematic fitting, it's always called the covariance matrix, so it's easy to mix up these things. Anyways, in general, this thing looks like this, right? So on the diagonal, you have the uncertainties for each particle variable, so momentum, theta, phi. And on the diagonal, you have the correlation contributions, right? And as I said, this matrix is symmetric, and this 3n times 3n matrix, right? Because you have n particles with three momentum components each. And again, I said it many times, but the kinematic fit will not work properly if you do not set up this thing right. And I will give you two examples what happens if you don't do it, actually. Also, what we discussed briefly last week was, last week, Monday, sorry, correlated and uncorrelated measurements, right? Again, imagine you have a subdetector and you want to measure the momentum of a particle. The particle enters in a certain angle and you have a uniform response of the detector. So no matter where the particle enters here, under which theta angle, you always get the same answer. This would be an uncorrelated measurement. But in real life, right, such a detector is really it's everyone's dream. But in real life, for instance, if you have a segmented detector, then you have efficiency gaps here in the borders where the different elements of the detector are stacked on top of each other. Right. So in this case, and if you now imagine that each element has different reconstruction efficiency, then you already have a theta-dependent resolution effect. And there are many ways to take this into account. Some people can just sit down, calculate it. That's not difficult, especially when things are more or less linear, right? Other people just take the data and then calculate the correlation with a correlation formula, like personal correlation coefficient, or there are so many things on the market. It's not that hard. In any case, if you know your detector, you also know the correlation matrix or the weight matrix. And then we talked about the chi-square distribution, how it should look like for a measurement with uncorrelated independent variables. This is the chi-square distribution for different numbers of degrees of freedom. I will talk about them in like 3 or 4 slides, so don't worry about that. So let's say you have your data, you perform a kinematic fit, and you obtain a chi-square. You would immediately compare this chi-square to one of these distributions, right? You would calculate it, of course, with the proper number of degrees of freedom. Then you would see, okay, where's any deviation? Why is there any deviation? And in most cases, the chi-square is also used as a discriminating variable, right? So let's say, again, you have a measurement, you set up a certain reaction, you do the kinematic fit, and then you say, okay, I accept all events with a chi-square, I don't know, smaller than 10 or so, whatever, right? So everything that would be smaller than 10 would be counted as event, and everything else would be counted as background. This is one way to do it. Another possibility to monitor the fit performance is probability. So the probability is directly correlated to the chi-square distribution. It's calculated with the chi-square, and it should ideally, perfect case should be flat. And this is actually very nice and interesting because so it should be flat. So if everything is set up correctly and we have the reaction in our data, we have the reactions we are looking at, and this thing should be flat. But for, let's say we see several events that are not the reaction we're looking for, and you would see a deviation in here. And I will give an example on that too as well. Just a moment. Okay. So let me first come to a summary of part one. So the goal is still to analyze proton-induced reactions. On Monday, I showed different possible monitoring plots. It's still a matter of taste. Sometimes people like different monitoring plots. I like those I showed. And we performed a very simple analysis, right? We looked at six particle final states, so plus, per minus, 2 photons and 2 protons, performed a cut on the pi zero mass, a cut on the overall missing mass, and it's basically shown here and ended up with this thing here. The green curve is basically our plus per minus pi zero invariant mass. And here are all etas, but also all direct produced pi plus per minus pi zero events. And of course, I introduced kinematic fitting. So this is where we kind of left off on Monday. And today will be a bit more, a bit more hands-on. We will use the kinematic fitter in analysis and see how it performs. I will also explain to you how to evaluate the kinematic fitter and a few practical aspects based on my own experience. And yeah, okay. First, a small addendum. I stated earlier in this lecture that the matrix, the weight matrix, hat V has to be diagonal. Otherwise, the least square method will not work. This is true. Explained in the Gauss-Markov theorem. However, what I forgot to mention last time, and I'm sorry about that, is there's an extension of this theorem by Aitken that in case that this weight matrix is similar or is equal, I mean, is equal to the covariance, symmetric covariance matrix, inverse symmetric covariance matrix, then this this theorem still holds. So we can still use the least square method. Okay. So again, sorry for that. I simply forgot to mention it, but least squares is still fine if you have a symmetric inverse covariance matrix as your weight matrix for the fit. Okay. All right. The big question is now how to set up this matrix, right? Where to start, how to do it. There are many ways to do it. I unfortunately know two, but I guess there are more. One is if you know your experiments and if you know the response of your detector with respect to different particle properties, then you can directly calculate the matrix elements. Let's say you know that for protons the resolution increases linearly in momentum. I don't know. Let's say you know that, and you would immediately put this into the matrix. Or another way you could do it, if you're not so sure about your, if you don't know the details of your detector, or if the correlations are too complicated, you can look at residuals. This is something we did at VAS at COSY. What are residuals? So residuals is what you basically do is you simulate your reaction or you simulate your detector, right, Monte Carlo, and you look at the true minus reconstructed properties, right, and this is technically the resolution of your observable. So here's an example for the photon kinetic energy, true minus reconstructed. You see it's more or less Gaussian, which is nice. And here now you see a parameter error parameterization. Right? You see the error of our photon kinetic energy or our photon energy as a function of theta and kinetic energy. Because just as a side note, the VASA detector, the calorimeter is phi symmetric. So phi doesn't go in here, right? Because it's phi symmetric. But there are some differences in theta, and this is actually what you see here. So this is the forward part of the calorimeter, and this is the end part. And you see the resolution is quite flat or low in the middle part because there we have a high granularity of crystals. But in the crystal size increases in the forward and in the end part of the calorimeter, so you have a worse resolution. This is what you nicely see here. So what I'm saying is, this is also one way to do it with residuals, but you need Monte Carlo for this. I would not prefer any over the other. It's whatever is at hand. If you can calculate things, I think it's always better if you can directly calculate things. But I advise you, if you ever come to use a kinematic filter, I always advise you to look at residuals as well, just to cross-check whether your error parameterization is reasonable. All right. Now, number of degrees of freedom. This is something, it's not too complicated, but it's also part of the, this is important when you want to calculate the probability, right? Because you need to know the number of degrees of freedom. So let's say we have, again, n particles which shall be fitted. What I didn't mention is, in our example, right, we do not fit the beam proton, the proton beam and the proton target. We don't fit them because we know the target is at rest and has a proton mass, and we know the bottom, a proton kinetic energy very well. So these are not part of the fit. So you have n particles, meaning you have 3 times n variables which go into the fitter. Right? So 3 times n parameters. Remember the epsilon vector, 3 times n, 3 times n long vector. Now you perform your experiment and you try to measure all particles and all particle components. And let's say you can only measure NM properties, meaning, of course, you want to measure all particle properties, but sometimes it might happen that you cannot access one, let's say, particle angle or momentum. It sometimes happens. Imagine you have a detector, sub-detector, and it's only working in a certain momentum range, yeah. So fast particles would not be measured there, kind of. So yeah, this has to be taken account as well. And we performed our kinematic fit on 4+n constraints. 4 because energy momentum conservation, right? We have constraint on px, py, pz, and energy. So that's 4. And c are any additional constraint like vertex, mass, or whatever, Right. So, yeah, it leads to this very simple formula. The number of variables you want to fit minus the number of variables you actually measured, which ideally should be 3n, ideally, and then plus the total number of constraints. Yeah, if you include the number of unknowns, you get this very handy formula, right? So NDF is 4 minus the number of unknowns plus the number of additional constraints. Very simple. In our case, in our mock experiment, we measured all particle momenta, angles, and so on. So it's just this, right? Meaning if you perform a kinematic fit without mass constraints, we have 4 degrees of freedom. That's all. Okay. Now, this is now one very important aspect of the kinematic fit are the so-called pool distributions. They are very, very, very important if you do kinematic fitting. You can't do kinematic fitting without looking at pool distributions, but they're also very painful. Because the nice thing about the kinematic fitter is what it does, it doesn't only provide us with the information about the improved resolution, it also gives us a new uncertainty on the measured quantities, fitted quantities, sorry. And this is how you define the pool distribution. So the pool distribution for a variable, let's say the momentum of your pi minus, is defined as the difference between the measured momentum minus the fitted momentum divided by the uncertainty you put into your covariance matrix minus the new uncertainty. So the idea behind this formula is as follows. Of course, you expect if the fit goes well that the uncertainty of the fitted value is smaller, right? You expect to have an improvement. And because we assumed earlier that all particles, all variables are Gaussian distributed with a certain sigma, the fitted quantities should be Gaussian too. So what you expect is that your pool distribution is also a Gaussian curve, right? And so ideally, if you look at your pool distribution, you expect it to have a mean at zero and a sigma of one, right? Again, all based on the fact that we assume that everything is Gaussian. Let's say you observe your pool distributions and you see that the sigma of your pool distribution is smaller than one. This means that the error you assign to your particle variable is too large. Right? So now you, because the error is so large and within the chi-square, you allow a lot of variance, so you narrow everything down basically. Right? You narrow everything just together because you allow such much variance. On the other hand, if you observe a sigma for your pool that is larger than one, means that your error is too small. Again, you just allow a tiny variation, and so your improvement is not much, so the pool is just wide. It also sometimes happens that your pool might not have a mean of zero. This means not a pool with non-zero mean means that your fitter kind of prefers a certain value, or the chi-square minimization ends up with a certain preferred value for this particular variable, and this is bias. This is not good. You should avoid that. And last but not least, the worst case, if you don't have Gaussian pool distributions, that is really bad. Then, I mean, let me tell you, in real life, most pool distributions are somewhat Gaussian-like. They are not perfectly Gaussian, but you have like Gaussian and with a tail or so. But if you see like something really asymmetric or weird, This is really bad. So we should take a look at this. All right. Are there any questions so far?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good.
Okay, good. Okay, here's now an example. We applied the kinematic fit on the data set where we only have the direct 3-pion production, where the pi zero decays into 2 photons. Okay. There are no additional constraints, just energy momentum conservation. So the number of degrees of freedom is 4. I did not a good job on setting the the covariance metrics properly. I mean, I kind of disobeyed of what I told you before. I just loosely, first I assumed it's diagonal, which it's obviously not. I set it to be diagonal and kind of loosely matched the resolution of the individual particles. Again, I was just too lazy to make a full calculation of this thing. Sorry for that, but I just wanted to show you how things look like. And this is the probability distribution. You see, it kind of looks okay. Yeah? I mean, it looks reasonable. And this is the pole distribution for the pi plus momentum. Right? And the mean is at zero. That's why I did not put it here. And the sigma is 1 point something. So this looks kind of promising. Now, what is here? So first thing is, if you compare this distribution to a flat distribution, we see we have this rising here. And first of all, this is not bad. This is not bad. This just means that you either have, for certain detector regions, most likely those where you have poor acceptance, you have underestimated your uncertainty, meaning your error there is too small, right? Or you have background contributions, which in this case does make sense because we look at the reaction we are fitting to. Or you have wrong PID. Right. This happens because I said we have a misidentification of 15% for pi plus and proton. So this is also stuff that ends up here. Yeah, or whatever can go wrong. So here is everything. If you look at the probability distribution for the reaction you're fitting to, this is mainly misreconstructed or misidentified particles. Or another estimated uncertainties in certain detector regions. Right. This is the more flat Tish part, and this is good. So this means that the covariance matrix is set more or less reasonable. Right? It's flat, it follows the assumption we made before, and the reaction hypothesis is fulfilled. And yeah, so of course, in real life, you would not just look at one pole, you would look at all poles for all particles, but I didn't want to produce so many plots. Now, in order to exclude this range, because I just want to look at the events that mostly follow this flattish curve, I put a cut on the probability, 10%. Yeah, so this distribution is obtained after a 10% cut. Again, it's more or less chosen arbitrarily. There are many ways to choose this cut. Sometimes people don't care about background rejection and they set it to a very low value. Other people prefer to set it in the region where the gradient of this curve is minimum, also whatever. I set it to 10%. I mean, you might have set it somewhere else, but just for demonstration. But in this case, you should set a cut because you don't want to have these misreconstructed guys showing up in your polls, because then this would falsify your information. All right. Now, to show you what happens if you kind of not set up your covariance matrix properly, what I did is I scaled down the covariance matrix by a factor of 5. Yeah? So imagine you have your covariance matrix and each element is now scaled down by a factor of 5, so 0.2. What this means is that all errors are now smaller than the original matrix I used for the plot before. And you see now the curve here is going down, right? And the sigma increased. Compared to the case before. And this is actually what refers to, corresponds to the table I showed before, right? Smaller errors lead to larger sigma for the pole distributions. Yeah, this is what you nicely see. So whenever you see a pole distribution with this kind of downward going slope, you can be sure that you have a global underestimation of your covariance matrix. So what you want to try first before tuning each element individually, you might just say, okay, I multiply them with a global factor of, I don't know, 2, 3, 4. Another example is what happens if you make your errors too large. So in this case, I scaled the covariance matrix up by a factor of 5. And then you see this guy. Now, so again, all errors are too large, so I allow much more variation. So I will most likely end up with a chi-square close to zero, which corresponds to a probability of 1. Yeah? And that is why the 1 is enhanced here, right? So again, large error, most likely chi-square with 0, so I end up here. And the sigma is now became smaller. if you see this is generally really bad. This means your errors are too large, and you should do something to get this under control. All right. Okay. Now, before we go to the analysis, there are a few things you should take care of. Again, you should check the probability distribution and see if there are any unexpected features, like a global downfalling slope or a rise at one or whatever. You should check the pool distributions definitely. Are they somewhat centered around zero? Do they have sigma close to one? And as I said, sometimes, not always, but sometimes the global scaling of the coherence matrix might be helpful. You should never, ever, never use a fitter blind analysis. This is just illegal. Don't do it. And also, you should always have a reference analysis at hand. So always have a, like in our case, we have this cut on pi zero, cut on missing mass, small analysis, right? We did last on we did on Monday. So always have a reference analysis with some results so that you can compare the performance. And also, when you use a kinematic fitter and you do your analysis, you might figure out that you have to retune the fitter several times. It's not nice, but it's quite normal. You barely get it right the first time. Yeah. Okay. So let's use the kinematic fitter in our analysis. The reaction hypothesis is proton-proton going to proton-proton and eta decaying to three pions and one pi zero decaying to photons. Fine. First of all, there's no constraint on the eta or pi zero mass. Okay. This is the probability curve. looks more or less reasonable. Fine. This is the missing momentum versus missing energy, and this is the two proton missing mass and the pi plus pi minus two photon final state invariant mass. You see, we have a blobish here, and of course, we would expect a distinct distribution at the eta mass because we're looking for eta. Now, if I and these are the reconstructed particle momenta, I should say. Now, if I apply the kinematic fit, meaning I put a cut on the probability, you see this, and you see this is a huge. Huge, how should I say, improvement. I'm showing the fitted form momenta here, just for demonstration. Of course, you would look at both distributions, the fitted as well, the reconstructed after cutting on the probability. But for demonstration purposes, I limited myself on the fitted momenta. And you see now, in the missing momentum versus missing energy plot, everything has shrunken down to zero. I mean, you see some outliers here, but everything has been shrunk down to zero because we enforced energy momentum conservation. And also here, you see this diagonal shape. Why do you see the diagonal shape? Well, because the missing mass and the invariant mass have to be the same, right? Kinematically, they have to be the same. So this is what the fitter does. Again, these things here are suboptimal. Meaning they require further investigation or improvement. So, meaning if you see something like this, this means you should recheck your fitter, and most likely you will have to retune the coherence matrix. But so far things look promising. Same channel, same fitter, but I just wanted to show you one more time the impact of the kinematic fitter. So here we see the two photon invariant mass. Right, and these are the large contributions from the direct pi plus pi minus production, right, due to the fact photons they are produced. And here is the missing missing mass of the total particle system, right, which should be at zero. And again, we apply the kinematic fit and look at the fitted particle momenta. You see, yeah, huge improvement. The two photon mass, you have reduced the background tremendously. Also here, everything is now squeezed to 0-0 because you enforce energy momentum conservation. As I said, you can perform the fitter in many different ways, which I will show in the following. So this was now a kinematic fit without any additional constraints, just energy momentum conservation. And you already saw that we suppressed the background a great deal and, of course, improved the resolution. But you might ask yourself, Yeah, but what about the pi zero? Why not forcing the two photons to be a pi zero? You can do that. So again, we have the same reaction hypothesis, but now we included the constraint that the two photons should, the inverse mass of the two photons should end up as a pi zero. And here you see in black, you see the corresponding inverted mass curve after the fit we did before, right? The one without any additional constraint, just energy momentum conservation. And in green, you see the corresponding inverted mass distribution for this fit, including the pi zero mass constraint. And you see, again, you see the fit, it's not perfect because actually there should be a delta distribution, which is not. But you see that the fit is working properly because everything is squeezed into the pi zero. Yeah? You see that this, tail or enhancement is now suppressed and kind of squeezed in here. And also, if you look at the missing mass versus the invalid mass, you also again notice the diagonal line, which shows that the fit is working properly. Now you can even go one step further and ask yourself, but why not requesting that all particles end up being eta? I mean, you can do that. It's not illegal, right? Again, same reaction, but this time we request that the pi plus, the pi minus, and the two photons have the eta mass. Right? Again, 10% cut. And here you see the comparison. The black curve is the invert mass, the fitted invert mass after the basic kinematic fitter without constraints. And the green curve is the invert mass after using this constraint. And you see again, the fitter did what it was supposed to do. It just forced everything to be a pi zero. At the end of this lecture, I will say one or two words about constraints, because they are not, they can be helpful, but sometimes not. But again, you see that in this case, it's working well. More or less COM technique is not doing only one kinematic fit in your analysis, but two. This is shown here. So here, I ran two fits in our analysis. So again, one is the normal one fitting for two protons, two ions, two photons. And the other one is fitting to our dominant background reaction, two protons and two ions. So on the x-axis, you have the probability from the reaction we're interested in. On the x-axis, you have the probability from the reaction that is our dominating background, namely the direct pion production. And you see they have some features, and what it is, I just very simply did a cut here. So I select all, reject all events that have this probability being larger than 5%. Again, you can do it different. You can do a multi-cut, hyperparameter, supercut, I don't know. But for simplicity, I just said everything that is in here, so within this rectangle is an event, is a signal event. And if you do this and then compare again two photon invert mass, you see that you have reduced this enhancement here, right? And this is actually nice because again, this enhancement corresponds to all events from direct two-pion production that survived this kinematic fit. But if you now include additional information from a second kinematic fit and basically reject this hypothesis, then you see a large suppression. Yeah? So again, if you do kinematic fit and you know that one reaction is definitely kind of spoiling your signal, it sometimes really helps to have two or more kinematic fits at once. It can be really powerful. All right. Quick summary. So here you see now all invalid masses after the different analysis steps we performed. The red one is after our simple analysis without kinematic fit, just cutting on two observables. The black curve is after the P4 fit, so energy momentum conservation. Green is including the pi zero constraint. Then magenta is with the pi zero constraint, and blue is including two kinematic fits. immediately, so you will see that we see that the kinematic fitter is working properly, but there are still some issues. Again, as I said, technically, the eta invariant mass or the pi zero invariant mass after including the constraint should be a delta distribution, which it is not. So we still need to do some tuning. And still we have a problem because based on these distributions, it's hard to judge how many contributions we have from direct pion production and from eta decaying to pions, right? So this is still an open issue that needs further attention. But I won't go into this because I just wanted to show you how and what the kinematic fitter is actually doing. All right. Now, where to go from here? Right? So we set up our kinematic fitter by defining a covariance matrix. We looked at the probability and the pole distributions and so on. Okay, things look reasonable. We put the kinematic fitter in different variations in our analysis and so on. Okay, it's working well. But what now? What are we supposed to do now? And again, someone else might do it different, but this is what I would do. First thing is you would redo the same analysis with Monte Carlo generated data and compare the results. This is the very first thing you do. Do things look similar? Do they look different? Why do they look different? The whole set of frustration. If you do your analysis in data Monte Carlo and for instance you compare the probability, there are many scenarios. Of course, if it's flat in data and Monte Carlo, that's wonderful. You can go on with the analysis. If it's not flat, but has some kind of weird slope, if it's the same, exactly the same in data Monte Carlo, this is not bad, actually. This is sometimes, no matter how much or how hard you try to tune your covariance metric, sometimes you won't get the probability distribution like nicely flat, or you still will have a tilt in it. It sometimes happens, depends on your experiment and whatnot. But if the probability distribution looks the same in data Monte Carlo, meaning has the same features, that's okay. That's okay. You can go on with the analysis, but you should keep in mind that there might be something odd. If it happens that the distributions look like significantly different, like there's a huge difference, then you want to retune your fitter, or retune Monte Carlo, or once more calibrate your data. And similar conclusions can be drawn for the poles. So again, if we have nicely Gaussian-shaped poles with mean at zero, sigma at one, and the same data Monte Carlo, just gone, wonderful. If the sigma is not exactly one, but somehow similar, you can go on. Or if the pole distributions are not at zero and have not the resolution of one, but they are again have identical shapes in data Monte Carlo, you can proceed for now, but should keep in mind that things might be off. And again, if things are totally different between these two data sets, you really have to retune your fitter or recalibrate your data. What you also want to do, so after these detailed comparisons, what you also want to check is how do invariant and missing masses or whatever kinematical observables look like in data Monte Carlo. Just want to check whether the fitter is not doing something weird in data, or maybe you have something data that you did not account for. You really want to be sure that you understand your data very well. Bottom line, never trust your fitter blindly. Yeah. The worst thing you can do is have your data and just throw a fitter at it and publish the result. That's a crime. Okay. Here's something that I did a while ago. This is one way you can do it. You don't have to do it like this, but this is comparing pole features. So I was looking at the reaction eta decaying to pi plus sines gamma. And on the y-axis, you see the pole features in Monte Carlo. On the x-axis, you see the pole features in data. This corresponds to the mean of the pole distribution. This one is for the sigma. And at that time I introduced two more variables, namely the curtices and skewness. So I kind of try to describe the asymmetry in the poles, if there's any, right? So the big red points define the ideal cases, right? So ideally, the mean in data Monte Carlo should be at zero, the sigma in data Monte Carlo should be at one, curtices and skewness should be at zero in data Monte Carlo as well. That's the ideal case. The diagonal lines, however, is the semi-ideal case, meaning that data Monte Carlo are the same, but not ideal. And as you see there, if you look at the individual points, you see things are quite off here, right? For instance, the proton, what is it? The proton kinetic energy is kind of off. So it's off in data Monte Carlo. It's really bad. Another thing you can do is to monitor physics observables, right? So again, I stated that you should always tune your fitter, but this doesn't mean that you just keep on tuning and tuning and tuning and until the end of days. No, this won't help you. So what I'm trying to say is you should do your analysis and whatever you're calculating, you should do it with your fitter once until the end and see how odd things are. Yeah, so perform the analysis until the end and see the impact of the fitter on your final result. This does not mean that you tune your fitter until your results look like the results you're looking for, right? So don't tune to PDG or your colleague's thesis. Don't do this. No. This is an example where I calculated the relative branching ratio between eta 2 pi pi gamma and eta 2 pi plus 1 pi 0. And I wasn't interested in the absolute value, right? I just was interested in the variation with respect to the kinematic fitter. And on the left-hand side, you see now this relative branch ratio is a function of the kinematic fit cut probability. And you see there's a clear dependency, and it shouldn't be, right? So this tells you that there's something off in data in Monte Carlo, because ideally this thing should be flat, because you use the Monte Carlo to do an efficiency correction, which immediately goes into this ratio. So I spent a lot of time on tuning Monte Carlo and obtained this. Again, this is not ideal, but you see the impact, right? I mean, you see this difference between this huge dependency and this. And it turned out that at that time, proton energy reconstruction was not realistic in Monte Carlo. So we had to introduce an additional smearing factor. That's quite some work. All right. Retuning the kinematic fit. I said it many times, but what does it mean actually? What does it mean to retune your kinematic fitter? Retuning means basically you assume that the algorithm is fine, but retuning means to update the covariance matrix. And there are also, again, many options. You can completely recalculate the covariance matrix. It's annoying and painful, but sometimes your only choice. You can rescale certain fractions of the covariance matrix. Let's say you know that that all particles besides the photons are fine. So then you would just rescale the photon parts in your covariance matrix. Or the latest and greatest is hyperparameter optimization. Those of you who might be familiar with machine learning and you might have heard of hyperparameter optimization. These are algorithms that kind of take whatever algorithm you have and they tune all corresponding parameters according to minimum information loss. And this is actually what you also can do with the kinematic fitter. So you take your fitter and you just throw a hyperparameter optimization on it. It's very fancy and it does the tuning for you, but it might take a very long time. So the choice is up to you. This is an example on how tuning might affect your fitter. So this is a work did in class. You see the probability distribution for row production, and the blue curve is the original fitter. You see it has an uprising slope, meaning our errors are too large. And they, in their kinematic fitter, these guys had two scaling factors, one for momentum and one for angles. So they used two scaling factors to manipulate the coherence metrics. And after some algorithm, I came to this flatter curve, right? You see now after tuning, the curve became more flat, so the errors are more reasonable. I also looked at the poles, of course, and the poles had a signal close to one, whereas beforehand it was smaller. All right. One word about mass constraints. How should I say it? I have mixed feelings about these. They can be very helpful, but they can also be very dangerous. Helpful is, let's say, you do not care about the particle you're constraining to. You just say, I want to reduce this background and let's say you have a background channel which is pi plus or minus gamma gamma, but your signal channel is pi plus or minus pi zero. And you don't care about the pi zero. You don't want to do anything with it. You don't want to get a cross-section out of it or don't want to use it for further calculation. You just want to get rid of the pi gamma gamma thing. In this case, the mass constraint is very helpful. Because it just suppresses your background and allows you to go on with the important stuff. But it is very dangerous when you're actually looking at this particle. Example, we are looking at the eta. In our case, the eta mass constraint would be very dangerous because, as I said before, it squeezes everything under this one Gaussian peak. So here is everything that passes the fit hypothesis plus this constraint. So there might be also, there are also pi plus from direct pi plus minus pi zero in, right? So you don't know what is the contribution, how much pi plus minus pi zero are in there, how much of them are direct production, how much of them are eta from the eta decay. You don't know because everything is forced into this one peak. So you have to think about it. When to use mass constraint, it really depends on what you want to do. If you're just interested in background rejection and don't use this particle at all, it's fine. But if you really need it for some further calculations, I advise you not to to use a mass constraint. All right. This is the last part of this lecture. It's just this one slide. Because I was asked last time, and building your own fitter. why would you want to do that? I mean, you can. It's actually not very difficult. I have to say, I won't give you a detailed calculation here. I will just give you a brief idea. Right? There are many papers and many articles you can read that do a much better job explaining it than I do. But I just want to give you a brief idea. And actually, to be very honest, the fitter we are using this analysis is actually one I wrote my own for learning and purposes. So one part of your homework will be actually to debug the fitter for me. All right, so the basic assumption is that the constraint functions are somewhat slowly varying with respect to the fitted values. So in other words, the Taylor expansion. If this is the constraint function for x, y, z, or the energy, and it's a function of the new fitted momenta, then you can say, okay, if this function varies slowly and linearly enough, you can approximate it by this. Now, this is just Taylor expansion, nothing too fancy. So this is the constraint function using your measured variables, right? The ones you already have. And epsilon is, again, the correction we get from the chi-square optimization. If you now translate this to these derivatives, so it's the derivative of the constraint function derived by basically the derivative with respect to your measured variables. This is the matrix B, and small f is basically the constraint function evaluated with your measured properties. Then you can rewrite the chi-square equation, right? You notice again this part with the correction factors, and now this part where we kind of approximated the constraint function with this B matrix and this constant factor. Yeah, this is a constant factor or constant vector, if you want to say. Yeah, then you're already there, right? Because now we expressed this complicated thing, however it might look like, into basically decomposed into a linear function, right? We have this prefactor or matrix in this case, and this constant vector. Now you can differentiate this equation with respect to epsilon, and you get this result for the correction. Yeah. Again, I know I'm doing a terrible job in explaining this, but I just want to give you a brief idea what are the basic ingredients for this. This S matrix has this form, fine. But again, in summary, forget all about these formulas. In this approach, what you just need to do is you just need to calculate this matrix B and the constant vector F. Both matrix B and this vector F are functions of the measured quantities, the ones you already have. This is nice. So when you calculate this, this is also trivial to calculate. If you calculate this, plug in your measured variables, then you can directly recalculate the correction factors based on this formula. One word of warning, this is an iterative procedure. So in most cases, you won't get it right the first iteration. So what you will do is you follow these steps, calculate epsilon, then you plug epsilon in here, redo the same Taylor expansion, do this, calculate a new epsilon, and so on. And then you go on and on and on until everything converges nicely. Yeah. All right. But again, this is just in case you really desperately want to build your own kinematic fitter, which I do not advise. All right. And this brings me to the end, summary and outlook. I introduced kinematic fitting techniques to physics data analysis. We learned that the kinematic fitter can either improve the resolution or suppress the background, or both, depending on what you want to do. Right? It really depends on what you want to do. I did not cover interesting things like vertex fitting, which is very nice, or fitting with unmeasured particles or missing particles. I'm sorry for that. I just didn't find enough material to deal with that. What I also would like to say and stress once more is I hope I convinced you that the kinematic fitter is a very nice and very powerful tool, but it's also very dangerous. I mean, you have to understand that you take three times n variables, and they all include detector resolution, acceptance effects, and whatnot, and you merge them all into one single variable, chi-square or probability. And then you cut on it and to reject physics events. This is kind of crazy. But this is why the fitter is so powerful. It's a multivariate analysis tool, but again, it's powerful but also very dangerous, so keep that in mind. Therefore one has to pay close attention to the fitter performance. Again, as I said, it's an iterative process. You set up your fitter, do your analysis, check the results, see, oh, something's odd, then you retune the fitter and go on and go on and go on. And of course, you do it parallel with your regular data set and your Monte Carlo data set. Yeah, it always goes in parallel. Whether to use a fitter or not, it's up to you. Sometimes, depending on which experiment you join, you don't have a choice because they say use it. I think it's up to you, but I would highly recommend to give it a try. I would say try it. It's not hard to understand. It's not difficult. It's just a tool. All right. And personal notice, most things I discussed here are based on my own experience with kinematic fitting. It is very, very, very likely that I missed something or that I didn't cover a topic in great detail. So you might want to ask other people who are experienced in kinematic fitting. Sean, Professor Dobbs, for example, is also very experienced in kinematic fitting, so he might also tell you a few more interesting details about this. And last but not least, one of the most important things to keep in mind is, I always like to quote a very brilliant colleague of mine, Andrzej Kupcz. He always said, analysis is a matter of taste. And I totally agree with that. It doesn't matter how you do it. It's up to you. As long as there is some logic is in there. Yeah. And I'm done. So that's it.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
On a side note to everyone else, are we doing another homework Zoom meeting?
I think we had agreed to maybe do something right after class today or some other time. Today, I think.
Yeah, I recall like after this class, and maybe possibly something on Thursday.
I will be sending the invitation after class.
All right, cool.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
One quick note: the homework will be available this afternoon or evening on the link I put on the slides. So, you know.
When is that due?
I have to talk to Sean, but if I remember, it's 2 weeks or so. But I have to talk to him. It's nothing crazy. It's nothing difficult. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye,
again,
everyone.
Thank you, Daniel. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah.
So, yeah.